drink," she commanded coldly. "Perhaps it will give you the courage to deal with truth for a change." Sansa lifted the cup to her lips and took a sip. The wine was cloyingly sweet, but very strong. "You can do better than that," Cersei said. "Drain the cup, Sansa. Your queen commands it." It almost gagged her, but Sansa emptied the cup, gulping down the thick, sweet wine until her head was swimming. "More?" Cersei asked. "No, please." The queen looked displeased. "When you asked about Sir Ilion earlier, I lied to you. Would you like to hear the truth, Sansa? Would you like to know why he's really here?" She did not dare answer, but it did not matter. The queen raised a hand and beckoned Nevo, waiting for a reply. Sansa had not even seen Sir Ilion return to the hall, but suddenly there he was, striding from the shadows behind the dais as silent as a cat. He carried ice, unsheathed. Her father had always cleaned the blade in the guardswood after he took a man's head, Sansa recalled. But Sir Ilion was not so fastidious. There was blood drying on the rippling steel, the red already fading to brown. "Tell Lady Sansa why I keep you by us," said Cersei. Sir Ilion opened his mouth and emitted a choking rattle. His puck-scarred face had no expression. "He's here for us, he says," the queen said. "Stannis may take the city, and he may take the throne. But I will not suffer him to judge me. I do not mean for him to have us alive." "Us? You heard me. So perhaps you had best pray again, Sansa, and for a different outcome. The Starks will have no joy from the fall of House Lannister, I promise you." She reached out and touched Sansa's hair, brushing it lightly away from her neck. Tyrion. The slot in his helm limited Tyrion's vision to what was before him, but when he turned his head, he saw three galleys beached on the tawny grounds, and a fourth, larger than the others, standing well out into the river, firing barrels of burning pitch from a catapult. "Wedge!" Tyrion commanded as his men streamed out of the sally port. They formed up in spearhead, with him at the point. Sir Mandon Moore took the place to his right, flame shimmering against the white enamel of his armor, his dead eyes shining passionlessly through his helm. He rode a coal-black horse, barded all in white, with a pure white shield of the King's Guard strapped to his arm. On the left, Tyrion was surprised to see Podrick Payne, a sword in his hand. "You're too young," he said at once. "Go back." "But I'm your squire, my lord." Tyrion could spare no time for argument. "With me, then. Stay close." He kicked his horse into motion. They rode knee to knee, following the line of the looming walls. Joffrey's standard streamed crimson and gold from Sir Mandon's staff, stag and lion dancing hoof to paw. They went from a walk to a trot, wheeling wide around the base of the tower. Arrows darted from the city walls, while stones spun and tumbled overhead, crashing down blindly onto earth and water, steel and flesh. Ahead loomed the King's Gate, and a surging mob of soldiers wrestling with a huge ram, a shaft of black oak with an iron head. Archers off the ships surrounded them, loosing their shafts at whatever defenders showed themselves on the gatehouse walls. "Lances!" Tyrion commanded. He sped to a canter. The ground was sodden and slippery, equal parts of mud and blood. His stallion stumbled over a corpse, his hooves sliding and churning the earth, and for an instant Tyrion feared his charge would end with him tumbling from the saddle before he could even reach the foe, but somehow he and his horse both managed to keep their balance. Beneath the gate, men were turning, hurriedly trying to brace for the shock. Tyrion lifted his axe and shouted, "King's Landing!" Other voices took up the cry, and now the arrowhead flew, a long scream of steel and silk, pounding hooves and sharp blades kissed by fire. Sir Mandon dropped the point of his lance at the last possible instant and drove Joffrey's banner through the chest of a man in a studded jerkin, lifting him full off his feet before the shaft snapped. Ahead of Tyrion was a knight whose surcoat showed a fox peering through a ring of flowers. Florent was his first thought, but helmless ran a close second. He smashed the man in the face with all the weight of axe and arm and charging horse, taking off half his head. The shock of impact numbed his shoulder. Shagor would laugh at me, he thought, riding on. A spear thudded against his shield. Pod galloped beside him, slashing down at every foe they passed. Dimly he heard cheers from the men on the walls. The battering ram crashed down into the mud, forgotten in an instant, as its handlers fled or turned to fight. Tyrion rode down an archer, opened a spearman from shoulder to armpit, glanced a blow off a swordfish-crested helm. At the ram, his big red reared, but the black stallion leapt the obstacle smoothly, and Sir Mandon flashed past him, death in snow-white silk. His sword sheared off limbs, cracked heads, broke shields asunder, though few enough of the enemy had made it across the river with shields intact. Tyrion urged his mount over the ram. Their foes were fleeing. He moved his head right to left and back again, but saw no sign of Podrick Payne. An arrow clattered against his cheek, missing his eye slit by an inch. His jolt of fear almost unhorsed him. If I'm to sit here like a stump, I had as well paint a target on my breastplate. He spurred his horse back into motion, trotting over and around a scatter of corpses. Downriver, the black water was jammed with the hulks of burning galleys. Patches of wildfire still floated atop the water, sending fiery green plumes swirling 20 feet into the air. They had dispersed the men on the battering ram, but he could see fighting all along the riverfront. Sir Balin Swan's men, most like, or Lancel's, trying to throw the enemy back into the water as they swarmed ashore off the burning ships. "We'll ride for the Mud Gate," he commanded. Sir Mandon shouted, "The Mud Gate!" And they were off again. "King's Landing!" his men cried raggedly, and "Half man! Half man!" He wondered who had taught them that. Through the steel and padding of his helm, he heard anguished screams, the hungry crackle of flame, the shuddering of war horns, and the brazen blast of trumpets. Fire was everywhere. Gods be good, no wonder the hound was frightened. It's the flames he fears. A splintering crash rang across the black water as a stone the size of a horse landed square amidships on one of the galleys. Ours or theirs? Through the roiling smoke, he could not tell. His wedge was gone. Every man was his own battle now. I should have turned back, he thought, riding on. The axe was heavy in his fist. A handful still followed him, the rest dead or fled. He had to wrestle his stallion to keep his head to the east. The big destrier liked fire no more than Sandor Clegane had, but the horse was easier to cow. Men were crawling from the river, men burned and bleeding, coughing up water, staggering, most dying. He led his troop among them, delivering quicker, cleaner deaths to those strong enough to stand. The war shrank to the size of his eye slit. Knights twice his size fled from him, or stood and died. They seemed little things and fearful. "Lannister!" he shouted, slaying. His arm was red to the elbow, glistening in the light off the river. When his horse reared again, he shook his axe at the stars and heard them call out, "Half man! Half man!" Tyrion felt drunk. The battle fever. He had never thought to experience it himself, though Jaime had told him of it often enough. How time seemed to blur and slow and even stop, how the past and the future vanished until there was nothing but the instant, how fear fled and thought fled, and even your body. You don't feel your wounds then, or the ache in your back from the weight of the armor, or the sweat running down into your eyes. You stop feeling, you stop thinking, you stop being you. There is only the fight, the foe, this man, and then the next, and the next, and the next. And you know that they are afraid and tired. But you're not. You're alive. And death is all around you. But their swords move so slowly, you can dance through them laughing. Battle fever. I'm half a man and drunk with slaughter. Let them kill me if they can. They tried. Another spearman ran at him. Tyrion lopped off the head of his spear, then his hand, then his arm, trotting around him in a circle. An archer, bowless, thrust at him with an arrow, holding it as if it were a knife. The destrier kicked at the man's thigh to send him sprawling, and Tyrion barked laughter. He rode past a banner planted in the mud, one of Stannis's fiery hearts, and chopped the staff in two with a swing of his axe. A knight rose up from nowhere to hack at his shield with a two-handed greatsword, again and again, until someone thrust a dagger under his arm. One of Tyrion's men, perhaps, he never saw. "I yield, sir," a different knight called out farther down the river. "Yield, sir knight, I yield to you, my pledge, here, here." The man lay in a puddle of black water, offering up a lobstered gauntlet in token of submission. Tyrion had to lean down to take it from him. As he did, a pot of wildfire burst overhead, spraying green flame. In the sudden stab of light, he saw that the puddle was not black, but red. The gauntlet still had the knight's hand in it. He flung it back. "Yield!" the man sobbed, hopelessly, helplessly. Tyrion reeled away. A man-at-arms grabbed the bridle of his horse and thrust at Tyrion's face with a dagger. He knocked the blade aside and buried the axe in the nape of the man's neck. As he was wresting it free, a blaze of white appeared at the edge of his vision. Tyrion turned, thinking to find Sir Mandon Moore beside him again. But this was a different white knight. Sir Balon Swan wore the same armor, but his horse trappings bore the battling black and white swans of his house. "Is more a spotted knight than a white one?" Tyrion thought inanely. Every bit of Sir Balon was splattered with gore and smudged by smoke. He raised his mace to point downriver. Bits of brain and bone clung to its head. "My lord, look!" Tyrion swung his horse about to peer down the Blackwater. The current still flowed black and strong beneath, but the surface was a roil of blood and flame. The sky was red and orange and garish green. "What?" he said. Then he saw. Steel-clad men-at-arms were clambering off a broken galley that had smashed into a pier. "So many? Where are they coming from?" Squinting into the smoke and glare, Tyrion followed them back into the river. 20 galleys were jammed together out there, maybe more. It was hard to count. Their oars were crossed, their hulls locked together with grappling lines. They were impaled on each other's rams, tangled in webs of fallen rigging. One great hulk floated hull up between two smaller ships. Wrecks, but packed so closely that it was possible to leap from one deck to the other and so cross the Blackwater. Hundreds of Stannis Baratheon's boldest were doing just that. Tyrion saw one great fool of a knight trying to ride across, urging a terrified horse over gunwales and oars across tilting decks slick with blood and crackling with green fire. "We made them a bloody bridge," he thought in dismay. Parts of the bridge were sinking, and other parts were afire, and the whole thing was creaking and shifting and like to burst asunder at any moment. But that did not seem to stop them. "Those are brave men," he told Sir Balon in admiration. "Let's go kill them." He led them through the guttering fires and the soot and ash of the riverfront, pounding down a long stone quay with his own men and Sir Balon's behind him. Sir Mandon fell in with them, his shield a ragged ruin. Smoke and cinders swirled through the air, and the foe broke before their charge, throwing themselves back into the water, knocking over other men as they fought to climb up. The foot of the bridge was a half-sunken enemy galley with Dragonsbane painted on her prow, her bottom ripped out by one of the sunken hulks Tyrion had placed between the quays. A spearman, wearing the red crab badge of House Celtigar, drove the point of his weapon up through the chest of Balon Swan's horse before he could dismount, spilling the knight from the saddle. Tyrion hacked at the man's head as he flashed by, but by then it was too late to rein up. His stallion leapt from the end of the quay and over a splintered gunwale, landing with a splash and a scream in ankle-deep water. Tyrion's axe went spinning, followed by Tyrion himself, and the deck rose up to give him a wet smack. Madness followed. His horse had broken a leg and was screaming horribly. Somehow he managed to draw his dagger and slit the poor creature's throat. The blood gushed out in a scarlet fountain, drenching his arms and chest. He found his feet again and lurched to the rail. And then he was fighting, staggering, and splashing across crooked decks awash with water. Men came at him. Some he killed, some he wounded, and some went away. But always there were more. He lost his knife and gained a broken spear. He could not have said how. He clutched it and stabbed, shrieking curses. Men ran from him, and he ran after them, clambering over the rail to the next ship and then the next. His two white shadows were always with him, Balon Swan and Mandan Moor, beautiful in their pale plate. Surrounded by a circle of Valyrian spearmen, they fought back to back. They made battle as graceful as a dance. His own killing was a clumsy thing. He stabbed one man in the kidney when his back was turned and grabbed another by the leg and upended him into the river. Arrows hissed past his head and clattered off his armor. One lodged between his shoulder and breastplate. He never felt it. A naked man fell from the sky and landed on the deck, body bursting like a melon dropped from a tower. His blood spattered through the slit in Tyrion's helm. Stones began to plummet down, crashing through the decks and turning men to pulp, until a whole bridge gave a shudder and twisted violently underfoot, knocking him sideways. Suddenly, the river was pouring into his helm. He ripped it off and crawled along the listing deck until the water was only neck deep. A groaning filled the air, like the death cries of some enormous beast. The ship, he had time to think, the ship's about to tear loose. The broken galleys were ripping apart, the bridge breaking apart. No sooner had he come to that realization than he heard a sudden crack, loud as thunder. The deck lurched beneath him, and he slid back down into the water. The list was so steep, he had to climb back up, hauling himself along a snapped line inch by bloody inch. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw the hulk they'd been tangled with drifting downstream with the current, spinning slowly as men leapt over her side. Some wore Stannis's flaming heart, some Joffrey's stag and lion, some other badges, but it seemed to make no matter. Fires were burning upstream and down. On one side of him was a raging battle, a great confusion of bright banners waving above a sea of struggling men, shield walls forming and breaking, mounted knights cutting through the press, dust and mud and blood and smoke. On the other side, the Red Keep loomed high on its hill, spitting fire. They were on the wrong sides, though. For a moment, Tyrion thought he was going mad, that Stannis and the castle had traded places. How could Stannis cross to the north bank? Belatedly, he realized that the deck was turning, and somehow he had gotten spun about, so the castle and battle had changed sides. Battle? What battle? If Stannis hasn't crossed, who is he fighting? Tyrion was too tired to make sense of it. His shoulder ached horribly, and when he reached up to rub it, he saw the arrow and remembered. I have to get off this ship. Downstream was nothing but a wall of fire, and if the wreck broke loose, the current would take him right into it. Someone was calling his name faintly through the din of battle. Tyrion tried to shout back, Here! Here! I'm here! Help me! His voice sounded so thin he could scarcely hear himself. He pulled himself up the slanting deck and grabbed for the rail. The hull slammed into the next galley over and rebounded so violently he was almost knocked into the water. Where had all his strength gone? It was all he could do to hang on. My lord, take my head! My lord Tyrion! There on the deck of the next ship, across a widening gulf of black water, stood Sir Mandan Moor, a hand extended. Yellow and green fire shone against the white of his armor, and his lobstered gauntlet was sticky with blood, but Tyrion reached for it all the same, wishing his arms were longer. It was only at the very last, as their fingers brushed across the gap, that something niggled at him. Sir Mandon was holding out his left hand. Why? Was that why he reeled backward? Or did he see the sword after all? He would never know. The point slashed just beneath his eyes, and he felt its cold, hard touch, and then a blaze of pain. His head spun around as if he'd been slapped. The shock of the cold water was a second slap more jolting than the first. He flailed for something to grab onto, knowing that once he went down, he was not like to come back up. Somehow his hand found the splintered end of a broken oar. Clutching it tight as a desperate lover, he shinned up foot by foot. His eyes were full of water, his mouth was full of blood, and his head throbbed horribly. "Gods, give me strength to reach the deck." There was nothing else, only the oar, the water, the deck. Finally, he rolled over the side and lay breathless and exhausted, flat on his back. Balls of green and orange flame crackled overhead, leaving streaks between the stars. He had a moment to think how pretty it was before Sir Mandon blocked out the view. The knight was a white steel shadow, his eyes shining darkly behind his helm. Tyrion had no more strength than a rag doll. Sir Mandon put the point of his sword to the hollow of his throat and curled both hands around the hilt. And suddenly he lurched to the left, staggering into the rail. Wood split, and Sir Mandon More vanished with a shout and a splash. An instant later, the hulls came slamming together again so hard the deck seemed to jump. Then someone was kneeling over him. "Jamie?" he croaked, almost choking on the blood that filled his mouth. Who else would save him, if not his brother?
"Be still, my lord. You're hurt bad."
A boy's voice. That makes no sense, thought Tyrion. It sounded almost like Pod. Sansa. When Sir Lancel Lannister told the Queen that the battle was lost, she turned her empty wine cup in her hands and said, "Tell my brother, sir." Her voice was distant, as if the news were of no great interest to her. "Your brother's likely dead." Sir Lancel's surcoat was soaked with the blood seeping out under his arm. When they had arrived in the hall, the sight of him had made some of the guests scream. "He was on the bridge of boats when it broke apart, we think. Sir Mandon's likely gone as well, and no one can find the hound. Gods be damned, Cersei, why did you have them fetch Joffrey back to the castle? The gold cloaks are throwing down their spears and running, hundreds of them. When they saw the king leaving, they lost all heart. The whole Blackwater's awash with wrecks and fire and corpses. But we could have held if..." Osne Kettleblack pushed past him. "There's fighting on both sides of the river now, Your Grace. It may be that some of Stannis' lords are fighting each other. No one's sure. It's all confused over there. The Hound's gone. No one knows where. And Sir Balin's fallen back inside the city. The riverside's theirs. They're ramming at the king's gate again, and Sir Lancel's right. Your men are deserting the walls and killing their own officers. There's mobs at the Iron Gate and the Gate of the Guards fighting to get out. And Flea Bottom's one great drunken riot." "Gods be good," Sansa thought. "It is happening. Joffrey's lost his head, and so have I." She looked for Sir Ilion, but the king's justice was not to be seen. "I can feel him, though. He's close. I'll not escape him. He'll have my head." Strangely calm, the queen turned to his brother, Osfrid. "Raise the drawbridge and bar the doors. No one enters or leaves Maegors without my leave. What about them women who went to pray?" "They chose to leave my protection. Let them pray. Perhaps the guards will defend them. Where's my son?"
"The castle gatehouse. He wanted to command the crossbowmen.
There's a mob howling outside, half of them gold cloaks, who came with him when we left the mud gate.
Bring him inside Magor's now.
No!
Lancel was so angry he forgot to keep his voice down.
Heads turned toward them as he shouted,
"We'll have the mud gate all over again. Let him stay where he is. He's the king."
"He's my son." Cersei Lannister rose to her feet.
"You claim to be a Lannister as well, cousin. Prove it. Osfrid, why are you standing there? Now means today."
Osfrid Kettleblack hurried from the hall, his brother with him. Many of the guests were rushing out as well. Some of the women were weeping, some praying. Others simply remained at the tables and called for more wine.
"Cersei," Sir Lancel pleaded, "if we lose the castle, Joffrey will be killed in any case, you know that.
Let him stay. I'll keep him by me, I swear."
"Get out of my way!"
Cersei slammed her open palm into his wound. Sir Lancel cried out in pain and almost fainted as the queen swept from the room. She spared Sansa not so much as a glance.
"She's forgotten me. Sir Ilyen will kill me, and she won't even think about it."
"Oh, gods!"
an old woman wailed.
"We're lost. The battle's lost. She's running."
Several children were crying.
They can smell the fear.
Sansa found herself alone on the dais. Should she stay here, or run after the queen and plead for her life? She never knew why she got to her feet, but she did.
"Don't be afraid," she told them loudly. "The queen has raised the drawbridge. This is the safest place in the city. There's thick walls, the moat, the spikes."
"What's happened?"
demanded a woman she knew slightly, the wife of a lesser lordling.
"What did Osney tell her? Is the king hurt? Has the city fallen? Tell us!"
Someone else shouted. One woman asked about her father, another her son. Sansa raised her hands for quiet. "Joffrey's come back to the castle. He's not hurt. They're still fighting, that's all I know. They're fighting bravely. The queen will be back soon." The last was a lie, but she had to soothe them. She noticed the fool standing under the galley.
"Moonboy, make us laugh."
Moonboy did a cartwheel and vaulted on top of a table. He grabbed up four wine cups and began to juggle them. Every so often, one of them would come down and smash him in the head. A few nervous laughs echoed through the hall. Sansa went to Sir Lancel and knelt beside him. His wound was bleeding afresh where the queen had struck him.
"Madness," he gasped. "Gods, the imp was right, was right."
"Help him,"
Sansa commanded two of the serving men. One just looked at her and ran, flagon and all. Other servants were leaving the hall as well, but she could not help that. Together, Sansa and the serving man got the wounded knight back on his feet.
"Take him to Maester Franken."
Lancel was one of them, yet somehow she still could not bring herself to wish him dead. "I am soft and weak and stupid, just as Joffrey says. I should be killing him, not helping him." The torches had begun to burn low, and one or two had flickered out. No one troubled to replace them. Cersei did not return. Sir Dantus climbed the dais while all eyes were on the other fool.
"Go back to your bedchamber, sweet Jonquil," he whispered. "Lock yourself in. You'll be safer there. I'll come for you when the battle's done."
"Someone will come for me," Sansa thought. "But will it be you, or will it be Sir Ilyen?" For a mad moment, she thought of begging Dantus to defend her. He'd been a knight too, trained with a sword and sworn to defend the weak. No, he has not the courage or the skill. I would only be killing him as well. It took all the strength she had in her to walk slowly from the queen's ballroom when she wanted so badly to run. When she reached the steps, she did run, up and around until she was breathless and dizzy. One of the guards knocked into her on the stair. A jeweled wine cup and a pair of silver candlesticks spilled out of the crimson cloak he'd wrapped them in and went clattering down the steps. He hurried after them, paying Sansa no mind, once he decided she was not going to try and take his loot. Her bedchamber was black as pitch. Sansa barred the door and fumbled through the dark to the window. When she ripped back the drapes, her breath caught in her throat. The southern sky was aswirl with glowing, shifting colors, the reflections of the great fires that burned below. Baleful green tides moved against the bellies of the clouds, and pools of orange light spread out across the heavens. The reds and yellows of common flame warred against the emeralds and jades of wildfire, each color flaring and then fading, birthing armies of short-lived shadows to die again an instant later. Green dawns gave way to orange dusks in half a heartbeat. The air itself smelled burnt, the way a soup kettle sometimes smelled if it was left on the fire too long and all the soup boiled away. Embers drifted through the night air like swarms of fireflies. Sansa backed away from the window, retreating towards the safety of her bed. "I'll go to sleep," she told herself, "and when I wake, it will be a new day, and the sky will be blue again. The fighting will be done, and someone will tell me whether I am to live or die." "Lady," she whimpered softly, wondering if she would meet her wolf again when she was dead. Then something stirred beside her, and a hand reached out of the dark and grabbed her wrist. Sansa opened her mouth to scream, but another hand clamped down over her face, smothering her. His fingers were rough and calloused and sticky with blood.
"Little bird, I knew you'd come."
The voice was a drunken rasp. Outside, a swirling lance of jade light split at the stars, filling the room with green glare. She saw him for a moment, all black and green, the blood on his face dark as tar, his eyes glowing like a dog's in the sudden glare. Then the light faded, and he was only a hulking darkness in a stained white cloak.
"If you scream, I'll kill you. Believe that."
He took his hand from her mouth. Her breath was coming ragged. The hound had a flagon of wine on her bedside table. He took a long pull.
"Don't you want to ask who's winning the battle, little bird?"
"Who?" she said, too frightened to defy him. The hound laughed.
"I only know who's lost. Me."
"He's drunker than I've ever seen him. He was sleeping in my bed. What does he want here?" "What have you lost?"
"All."
The burnt half of his face was a mask of dried blood.
"Bloody dwarf. Should have killed him years ago."
"He's dead, they say."
"Dead? Oh, bugger that. I don't want him dead."
He cast the empty flagon aside.
"I want him burned. If the gods are good, they'll burn him. But I won't be here to see. I'm going."
"Going?" She tried to wriggle free, but his grasp was iron.
"The little bird repeats whatever she hears. Going, yes."
"Where will you go?"
"Away from here. Away from the fires. Go out the iron gate, I suppose. North somewhere. Anywhere."
"You won't get out," Sansa said. "The Queen's closed up Maegor's, and the city gates are shut as well."
"Not to me. I have the white cloak, and I have this."
He patted the pommel of his sword.
"The man who tries to stop me is a dead man. Unless he's on fire."
He laughed bitterly. "Why did you come here?"
"You promised me a song, little bird. Have you forgotten?"
She didn't know what he meant. She couldn't sing for him now, here, where the sky is swirl with fire and men dying in their hundreds and their thousands. "I can't," she said. "Let me go. You're scaring me."
"Everything scares you. Look at me. Look at me."
The blood masked the worst of his scars, but his eyes were white and wide and terrifying. The burnt corner of his mouth twitched and twitched again. Sansa could smell him, a stink of sweat and sour wine and stale vomit, and over it all, the reek of blood. Blood. Blood.
"I could keep you safe," he rasped. "They're all afraid of me. No one would hurt you again, or I'd kill them."
He yanked her closer,
and for a moment she thought he meant to kiss her. He was too strong to fight. She closed her eyes, wanting it to be over. But nothing happened.
"Still can't bear to look, can you?"
she heard him say. He gave her arm a hard wrench, pulling her around and shoving her down onto the bed.
"I'll have that song. Florian and Jonquil, you said."
His dagger was out, poised at her throat.
"Sing, little bird, sing for your little life."
Her throat was dry and tight with fear, and every song she had ever known had fled from her mind. "Please don't kill me," she wanted to scream. "Please don't." She could feel him twisting the point, pushing it into her throat, and she almost closed her eyes again. But then she remembered. It was not the song of Florian and Jonquil, but it was a song. Her voice sounded small and thin and tremulous in her ears.
"Gentle mother, fount of mercy, save our sons from war, we pray. Stay the swords and stay the arrows, let them know a better day. Gentle mother, strength of women, help our daughters through this fray. Soothe the wrath and tame the fury, teach us all a kind way."
She had forgotten the other verses. When her voice trailed off, she feared he might kill her. But after a moment, the hound took the blade from her throat, never speaking. Some instinct made her lift her hand and cup his cheek with her fingers. The room was too dark for her to see him, but she could feel the stickiness of the blood and a wetness that was not blood.
"Little bird,"
he said once more, his voice raw and harsh as steel on stone. Then he rose from the bed. Sansa heard cloth ripping, followed by the softer sound of retreating footsteps. When she crawled out of bed, long moments later, she was alone. She found his cloak on the floor, twisted up tight, the white wall stained by blood and fire. The sky outside was darker by then, with only a few pale green ghosts dancing against the stars. A chill wind was blowing, banging the shutters. Sansa was cold. She shook out the torn cloak and huddled beneath it on the floor, shivering. How long she stayed there, she could not have said, but after a time she heard a bell ringing, far off across the city. The sound was a deep-throated bronze booming, coming faster with each knell. Sansa was wondering what it might mean when a second bell joined in, and a third, their voices calling across the hills and hollows, the alleys and towers, to every corner of King's Landing. She threw off the cloak and went to her window. The first faint hint of dawn was visible in the east, and the Red Keep's own bells were ringing now, joining in the swelling river of sound that flowed from the seven crystal towers of the Great Sept of Baelor. They had rung the bells when King Robert died, she remembered, but this was different. No slow, dolorous death knell, but a joyful thunder. She could hear men shouting in the streets as well, and something that could only be cheers. It was Ser Dontus who brought her the word. He staggered through her open door, wrapped her in his flabby arms, and whirled her round and around the room, whooping so incoherently that Sansa understood not a word of it. He was as drunk as the hound had been, but in him it was a dancing, happy drunk. She was breathless and dizzy when he let her down. "What is it?" She clutched at a bedpost. "What's happened? Tell me."
"It's done, done, done. The city is saved. Lord Stannis is dead. Lord Stannis has fled. No one knows. No one cares. His host is broken. The danger's gone. Slaughtered, scattered, or gone over, they say. Oh, the bright banners, the banners, Jonquil, the banners. You have any wine? We ought to drink to this day. Yes.
It means you're safe, don't you see? Tell me what's happened. Sansa shook him. Sir Dontus laughed and hopped from one leg to the other, almost falling. They came up through the ashes while the river was burning. The river, oh, Stannis was neck deep in the river, and they took him from the rear. Oh, to be a knight again, to have been part of it. His own men hardly fought, they say. Some ran, but more bent the knee and went over, shouting for Lord Renly. What must Stannis have thought when he heard that? I had it from Osney Kettleblack, who had it from Sir Osmond, but Sir Balin's back now, and his men say the same, and the gold cloaks as well. We're delivered, sweet laden. They came up the Rose Road and along the riverbank through all the fields Stannis had burned, the ashes puffing up around their boots and turning all their armour grey. But, oh, the banners must have been bright. The Golden Rose and Golden Lion and all the others, the Marbran Tree and the Rowan, Tarly's Huntsman and Red Wine's Grapes and Lady Oakheart's Leaf, all the Westermen, all the power of Highgarden and Castle Rock, Lord Tywin himself, at their right wing on the north side of the river, with Randall Tarly commanding the centre and Mace Tyrell the left. But the vanguard won the fight. They plunged through Stannis like a lance through a pumpkin, every man of them howling like some demon in steel. And you know who led the vanguard? Do you? Do you? Do you? Rob? It was too much to be hoped, but it was Lord Renly. Lord Renly in his green armour with the fire shimmering off his golden antlers. Lord Renly with his tall spear in his hand. They say he killed Sir Gaiad Morrigan himself in single combat and a dozen other knights as well. It was Renly. It was Renly. It was Renly. Oh, the banners, darling, Sansa. Oh, to be a knight.
Daenerys. She was breaking her fast on a bowl of cold shrimp and persimmon soup, when Eri brought her a Carthian gown, an airy confection of ivory samite patterned with seed pearls. "Take it away," Danny said. "The docks are no place for ladies' finery." If the milkman thought her such a savage, she would dress the part for them. When she went to the stables, she wore faded sand silk pants and woven grass sandals. Her small breast moved freely beneath a painted Dothraki vest, and a curved dagger hung from her medallion belt. Jiqui had braided her hair Dothraki fashion and fastened a silver bell to the end of the braid. "I have won no victories," she tried telling her handmaid when the bell tinkled softly. Jiqui disagreed. "You burned the Magi in their house of dust and sent their souls to hell." "That was Drogon's victory, not mine," Danny wanted to say, but she held her tongue. The Dothraki would esteem her all the more for a few bells in her hair. She chimed as she mounted her silver mare, and again with every stride, but neither Ser Jorah nor her blood riders made mention of it. To guard her people and her dragons in her absence, she chose Rhaecara. Jogo and Aego would ride with her to the waterfront. They left the marble palaces and fragrant gardens behind, and made their way through a poorer part of the city where modest brick houses turned blind walls to the street. There were fewer horses and camels to be seen and a dearth of palanquins, but the streets teemed with children, beggars, and skinny dogs the colour of sand. Pale men in dusty linen skirts stood beneath arched doorways to watch them pass. "They know who I am, and they do not love me," Danny could tell from the way they looked at her. Ser Jorah would sooner have tucked her inside her palanquin, safely hidden behind silken curtains, but she refused him. She had reclined too long on the satin cushions, letting oxen bear her hither and yon. At least when she rode, she felt as though she were getting somewhere.
It was not by choice that she sought the waterfront. She was fleeing again. Her whole life had been one long flight, it seemed. She had begun running in her mother's womb and never once stopped. How often had she and Viserys stolen away in the black of night, a bare step ahead of the usurper's hired knives? But it was run or die. Zaro had learned that Pyat Pree was gathering the surviving warlocks together to work ill on her. Danny had laughed when he told her. Was it not you who told me warlocks were no more than old soldiers, vainly boasting of forgotten deeds and lost prowess? Zaro looked troubled.
And so it was then, but now I am less certain. It is said that the glass candles are burning in the house of Urath the Nightwalker, that have not burned in 100 years. Ghost grass grows in the garden of Gathain. Phantom tortoises have been seen carrying messages between the windowless houses on Warlock's Way, and all the rats in the city are chewing off their tails. The wife of Mathis Malarawan, who once mocked a warlock's drab, moth-eaten robe, has gone mad and will wear no clothes at all. Even fresh-washed silks make her feel as though 1,000 insects were crawling on her skin. And blind Sybassian, the eater of eyes, can see again, or so his slaves do swear. Oh, a man must wonder, he sighed. These are strange times in Karth, and strange times are bad for trade. It grieves me to say so, yet it might be best if you left Karth entirely, eh? And sooner rather than later.
Zara stroked her fingers reassuringly.
You need not go alone, though. You have seen dark visions in the Palace of Dust, but Zaro has dreamed brighter dreams. I see you happily abed, with our child at your breast. Sail with me around the Jade Sea, and we can yet make it so. It is not too late. Give me a son, my sweet song of joy.
Give you a dragon, you mean? I will not wed you, Zaro. His face had grown cold at that.
Then go.
But where?
Somewhere, far from here.
Well, perhaps it was time. The people of Akalasar had welcomed the chance to recover from the ravages of the Red Waste. But now that they were plump and rested once again, they began to grow unruly. Dothraki were not accustomed to staying long in one place. They were a warrior people, not made for cities. Perhaps she had lingered in Karth too long, seduced by its comforts and its beauties. It was a city that always promised more than it would give you, it seemed to her, and her welcome, here, had turned sour since the House of the Undying had collapsed in a great gout of smoke and flame. Overnight, the Karthian had come to remember that dragons were dangerous. No longer did they vie with each other to give her gifts. Instead, the Tourmaline Brotherhood had called openly for her expulsion, and the ancient Guild of Spices for her death. It was all Zaro could do to keep the 13 from joining them. But where am I to go? Sir Jorah proposed that they journey farther east, away from her enemies in the Seven Kingdoms. Her blood riders would sooner have returned to their great grass sea, even if it meant braving the Red Waste again. Danny herself had toyed with the idea of settling in Vaes Tolaro until her dragons grew great and strong, but her heart was full of doubts. Each of these felt wrong somehow, and even when she decided where to go, the question of how she would get there remained troublesome. Zarozoan Daxus would be no help to her. She knew that now. For all his professions of devotion, he was playing his own game, not unlike Pyat Pree. The night he asked her to leave, Danny had begged one last favor of him.
An army, is it?
Zaro asked.
A kettle of gold? A galley, perhaps?
Danny blushed. She hated begging. A ship, yes. Zaro's eyes had glittered as brightly as the jewels in his nose.
I'm a trader, Khaleesi, so perhaps we should speak no more of giving, eh? But rather of trade. For one of your dragons, you shall have 10 of the finest ships in my fleet. You need only say that one sweet word.
No,
she said. Alas, Zaro sobbed, that was not the word I meant.
Would you ask her mother to sell one of her children?
Why ever not, eh? They can always make more. Mothers sell their children every day.
Not the mother of dragons?
Not even for 20 ships?
Not for 100? His mouth curled downward.
I do not have 100, but you have 3 dragons, huh? Grant me one for all my kindnesses. You will still have 2, and 30 ships as well.
30 ships would be enough to land a small army on the shores of Westeros. But I do not have a small army. How many ships do you own, Zaro?
83, if one does not count my pleasure barge.
And your colleagues in the 13?
Among us all, perhaps 1,000.
And the Spices and the Tourmaline Brotherhood?
Their trifling fleets are of no account.
Even so, she said, tell me.
1,200 or 1,300 for the Spices. No more than 800 for the Brotherhood.
And the Ashayi, the Bravasi, the Summer Islanders, the Ibanese, and all the other peoples who sail the Great Salt Sea, how many ships do they have all together?
Many and more, he said irritably. What does this matter?
I'm trying to set a price on one of the 3 living dragons in the world. Danny smiled at him sweetly. It seems to me that 1/3 of all the ships in the world would be fair. Zara's tears ran down his cheeks on either side of his jewel-encrusted nose.
Did I not warn you not to enter the Palace of Dust, eh? This is the very thing I feared. The whispers of the warlocks have made you as mad as Malarawan's wife. 1/3 of all the ships in the world? Ha! I say, ha!
Danny had not seen him since. His seneschal brought her messages, each cooler than the last. She must quit his house. He was done feeding her and her people. He demanded the return of his gifts, which she had accepted in bad faith. Her only consolation was that at least she had had the great good sense not to marry him. The warlocks whispered of 3 treasons, once for blood, and once for gold, and once for love. The first traitor was surely Miramazdur, who had murdered Khal Drogo and their unborn son to avenge her people. Could Pyat Pree and Zarozo and Daxus be the 2nd and the 3rd? She did not think so. What Pyat did was not for gold, and Zaro had never truly loved her. The streets grew emptier as they passed through a district given over to gloomy stone warehouses. Aegor went before her and Jogo behind, leaving Ser Jorah Mormont at her side. Her bell rang softly, and Dany found her thoughts returning to the Palace of Dust once more, as the tongue returns to a space left by missing tooth. Child of 3, they had called her. Daughter of Death. Slayer of Lies. Bride of Fire. So many 3s. 3 fires. 3 mounts to ride. 3 treasons. The dragon has 3 heads, she sighed. Do you know what that means, Jonah?
Your Grace, the sigil of House Targaryen is a 3-headed dragon, red on black.
I know that. But there are no 3-headed dragons.
The 3 heads were Aegon and his sisters.
Visenya and Rhaenys, she recalled. I am descended from Aegon and Rhaenys through their son Aenys and their grandson Jaehaerys.
Blue lips speak only lies. Isn't that what Zaro told you? Why do you care what the warlocks whispered? All they wanted was to suck the life from you. You know that now.
Perhaps, she said reluctantly. Yet the things I saw...
A dead man in the prow of a ship, a blue rose, a banquet of blood. What does any of it mean, Khaleesi? A mummer's dragon, you said. What is a mummer's dragon, pray?
A cloth dragon on poles, Danny explained. Mummers use them in their follies to give the heroes something to fight. Sir Jorah frowned. Danny could not let it go. His is the song of ice and fire, my brother said. I'm certain it was my brother, not Viserys, Rhaegar. He had a harp with silver strings. Sir Jorah's frown deepened until his eyebrows came together.
Prince Rhaegar played such a harp, he conceded. You saw him?
She nodded. There was a woman in a bed with a babe at her breast. My brother said the babe was the prince that was promised and told her to name him Aegon.
Prince Aegon was Rhaegar's heir by a liar of Dorn, Sir Jorah said. But if he was the prince that was promised, the promise was broken along with his skull when the Lannisters dashed his head against a wall.
I remember, Danny said sadly. They murdered Rhaegar's daughter as well, the little princess. Rhaenys, she was named, like Aegon's sister. There was no Visenya, but he said the dragon has three heads. What is the song of ice and fire?
It's no song I've ever heard.
I went to the warlocks hoping for answers, but instead they've left me with 100 new questions. By then, there were people in the streets once more.
Make way!
Aegor shouted, while Jogo sniffed at the air suspiciously.
I smell it, Khaleesi, he called. The poison water.
The Dothraki distrusted the sea and all that moved upon it. Water that a horse could not drink was water they wanted no part of. They will learn, Danny resolved. I braved their sea with Khal Drogo. Now they can brave mine. Carth was one of the world's great ports, its great sheltered harbor, a riot of color and clangor and strange smells. Wine sinks, warehouses, and gaming dens lined the streets, cheek by jowl with cheap brothels and the temples of peculiar gods. Cut purses, cut throats, spell sellers, and money changers mingled with every crowd. The waterfront was one great marketplace where the buying and selling went on all day and all night, and goods might be had for a fraction of what they cost at the bazaar, if a man did not ask where they came from. Wizened old women, bent like hunchbacks, sold flavored waters and goat's milk from glazed ceramic jugs strapped to their shoulders. Seamen from 50 nations wandered amongst the stalls, drinking spiced liquors and trading jokes in queer-sounding tongues. The air smelled of salt and frying fish, of hot tar and honey, of incense and oil and sperm. Ego gave an urchin a copper for a skewer of honey-roasted mice and nibbled them as he rode. Jogo bought a handful of fat white cherries. Elsewhere they saw beautiful bronze daggers for sale, dried squids, and carved onyx, a potent magical elixir made of virgin's milk and shade of the evening. Even dragon's eggs, which looked suspiciously like painted rocks. As they passed the long stone quays reserved for the ships of the 13, she saw chests of saffron, frankincense, and pepper being offloaded from Zaro's ornate vermilion kiss. Beside her, casks of wine, bales of sour leaf, and pallets of striped hides were being trundled up the gangplank onto the Bride in Azure, to sail on the evening tide. Farther along, a crowd had gathered around the Spicer Galley, Sunblaze, to bid on slaves. It was well known that the cheapest place to buy a slave was right off the ship, and the banners floating from her mast proclaimed that the Sunblaze had just arrived from Astapor on Slaver's Bay. Danny would get no help from the 13, the Tormalai Brotherhood, or the Ancient Guild of Spices. She rowed her silver past several miles of their quays, docks, and storehouses, all the way out to the far end of the horseshoe-shaped harbor where the ships from the Summer Islands, Westeros, and the Nine Free Cities were permitted to dock. she dismounted beside a gaming pit, where a basilisk was tearing a big red dog to pieces amidst a shouting ring of sailors. Aegor, Jogo, you will guard the horses while Sir Jorah and I speak to the captains.